voice of God. And I'm Al Pitcher. I might say a word about myself while we're waiting for maybe one or two more. I've been at Holden many times from 72 to 77. My wife and I came from 4 to 9 weeks each summer. Then we came back in, she came in 83. I went to Central America with Jesse Jackson. We came in 84. We came from 89 to 91, 21 months, and we came in 92. So some people say we think we own this place. And I have five kids from 15 to 52, and nine grandkids. And I started Intentional Community in 77. We own a 20 flat building, and very interesting history there. We started a development corporation in this all-black community. We live right next to the University of Chicago. I'm the Minister for Social Concerns in a church, a UCC, United Church of Christ and Disciples Church, 10 hours a week, 9 months of the year. Sometimes they say I have a third of the program. At any rate, I was very active in the civil rights movement. I spent 7 years on Jesse Jackson's staff. I just called him up on my 80th birthday to suggest a new project for him, and us probably. And I'm about to get my first book published. I have the galley proofs here. And I taught at the University of Chicago 26 years, so that it was the 21 months here that got me involved with the environment and led me to, it was kind of accidental, but then it became a very conscious decision. And it's my hypothesis, I'll give you sort of what I'm going to do today, summary, because I may never get to it. So first, there is an environmental revolution, and I can't prove it, but I'll kind of assume it. And then the environmental revolution points to the judgment of God. And if we listen to it, we hear the voice of God. That's the fundamental point. And if we don't listen to it, we won't hear the voice of God for our day. Well, we could hear it through the violence, which we'll talk about in our forum this week. At any rate, and you know, some people are talking about it here. The third point is, what is God saying to us? And what I'm saying is that the character and content of this word that God is saying to us is a real challenge to the image of God that we have, to the content of the image of God that we have. Our theology, in other words, is a problem. Both the notion of God that we have and the notion of the character of the image of God we have is questioned by the environmental revolution. And then I want to talk a little bit about the implications for us. You know, I can do it in economic theory and practice, politics, education, the church, and us as persons. Well, that's, of course, the content of my book. So we won't get over all of it, but I will give you the kind of heart of where I am personally in this adventure of life and Christian responsibility. First, there is an environmental revolution. That is to say, there are some things going on in our world which are really devastating and call everything that we're about into question. Without even being aware of it, human activity has affected the physical, chemical, biological framework for human life. What we refer to as nature, the natural world, the earth. Changes in the capacity of the earth to prevent heat radiation from the earth, allegedly produced by greenhouse gases, which we provide, carbon dioxide, chlorofluorocarbons, methane, nitrous oxide, threaten to raise the temperature. Varying assessments of this. My oldest son is working on a big computer model to measure all of this. And it keeps changing. And just recently he said that we've said that chlorofluorocarbons are responsible for 25% of global warming. He says, well, if the chlorofluorocarbons go up there and they change the ozone, well, ozone in the atmosphere was responsible for some of the global warming too, he asserts. So they cancel each other out. I don't want to insist that in any way this is all obvious, and it's a human judgmental decision as to how serious global warming is. I think it's serious. And my opponent's new book came out called Echo Scam, which would insist that I am simply one of those persons who thinks that the government ought to do everything, and so I'm using the environmental revolution. They've said it to my face that that's the reason I'm interested in this. Well, there are real problems, I think, with the ozone. But even this, the opponents of the environmentalists will say, is not a real problem. They say, there's nothing happening. And, you know, we've had people stand right here who've been in the airplanes going up to measure the ozone depletion in the Antarctic, and yet they will say there isn't any real problem. And it's clear, at least to me, people that are close to the Antarctic are not letting their children out of school during the day. In Australia, they say they keep their children in from 10 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. They won't let them out of school because of the problem, particularly during the winter months there when the ozone has been decreased 12 or some odd percent because the swirling winds, somehow the atmospheric movement during the winter brings that ozone hole over Australia. And they say, I was reading in one of the magazines, Time or Newsweek, that the rabbits are blind in southern Patagonia, that there are things happening. And of course it said that this will affect our eyes, our immune systems, and cause skin cancer, all kinds of predictions about the increases in skin cancer. And I won't go out practically without something on me or with a hat or something. At any rate, the water problems with the increased irrigation, shortages. California, of course, now after the drought was kind of relieved for a while. But the predictions are that there'll be more of these droughts and more of these interferences with our climate and more storms. I mean, if you saw After the Warning, which is a video, you will see the depiction of all kinds of storms. And, you know, the fact is if it gets warmer, it'll get warmer at the equator, more warmth at the equator than at the poles. More of the increase will be there, and then you'll have more differentials and then more wind movement. And it's natural that you get more hurricanes and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it seems natural to me and logical, but who is to say whether it's going to happen? I'm just indicating that climate change will be disastrous for the whole world. And insofar as human action is causing climate change or might cause climate change, we have a problem. Population, it's hard to say that this is a problem of the natural world, but the way the population increases in the developing nations means that the population invades the forest, destroys the forest, destroys the forests which keep the land from being eroded and flowing into the ocean. 25 billion tons of soil go into the ocean every year. 4 billion tons from the United States, where our soil is simply flowing into the ocean. And the deforestation that's occurring, land is being degraded. Green revolution is slowing down. 1.2 billion people chronically hungry. 40,000 kids under five dying every day of hunger. Every day of hunger. 40,000 kids under five every day. Deforestation, pollution. They say we could bury all the pollution we have in somewhere between here and the Mississippi River, that there's plenty of land, and there certainly is a lot of land. We just drove across it from Chicago, and there's lots of land. Of course, nobody wants it. And they're now advocating dumping it in the third world countries on the thesis that the third world people don't earn much money anyway, so they're not very important to the international economy. It's an unbelievable rationale that you read, and people with the World Bank and assert the species are being destroyed. Who knows what that means? 7,500 of the 75,000 species known to have edible parts have been destroyed. How important this genetic pool is, I don't know. There are maps which show you the genetic pools and the places where the original new strains emerged. And so where the genetic pools are much stronger and much more, with much more variety. And there are very, very few places in the world where these genetic pools are in such a prolific presence, and they're being destroyed. And then you get all the sulfur oxide, nitrogen oxides, hydrocarbons, carbon monoxide, and everything coming out of our cars. I have a study which showed that we could reduce the amount of fossil fuels we use by a half if we had just energy efficiency. You know, I once said it's a sin to drive a car that doesn't get, I said, 50 miles per gallon, if you can afford to buy one. But I tried to get that car, and I couldn't get it. Most I could get was a Honda Civic, which might get 45 if you don't have the air conditioning on, and you're not driving through the mountains, and you are, not accelerating too much and not driving too fast and all those things. But they can produce cars getting 75 miles a gallon. You know they have the technology. All the prototypes are there. And some people say the problem is with safety. And I've read studies from the Office of Technology Assessment which said, well, we can handle the safety. You know, the safety is chiefly the wheel bed of the car. And any rate, all I'm saying is, I think that there's a real issue with the way we are treating the world of the non-human world and the way the non-human world and the human world are interacting. So what I call an environmental revolution is taking place. And I stole a phrase from one of the State of the Worlds, which I have here. And the point I want to make is that we need to listen to this stuff. And my summary is no excuse or no substitute for reading it in something like the State of the World. And of course, the conservatives say that this is a radical progressive point of view, that Lester Brown has been promoting the downfall of the world for 20 years and it hasn't fallen apart yet. And but I find it as important as the Bible to read. Or you could read Al Gore's book, Earth in the Balance. When I first read that, I wrote Al Gore and I said, the best thing I can do is promote you for president. The best thing I could do with my time for the next 4 years. Little did I know that he was going to be the vice president. And I don't know what it means to be the vice president. It usually doesn't mean that you have much influence at all, but who knows. At any rate, there is an environmental revolution. That's the point, first point. Now, the second point is the environmental revolution points to the judgment of God. And it's very interesting what you find in the Bible when you go at it with certain eyes. And so I've been reading it, and in Jeremiah 3, 1 through 5, I find this. If a man divorces his wife and she goes from him and becomes another man's wife, will he return to her? Would not that land be greatly polluted? You have played the harlot with many lovers, figurative, and would you return to me? Lift up your eyes to the bare heights and see. Where have you not been lain with? By the waysides you have sat awaiting lovers like an Arab in the wilderness. You have polluted the land with your vile harlotry. Therefore, the showers have been withheld, and the spring rain has not come. I mean, you disobey God, and what happens? It doesn't rain. Now that seems pretty far-fetched, doesn't it? Pretty far-fetched. But you find it in Jeremiah, and you find it in Ezekiel. Jesus said, thus says the Lord, as I live, surely those who are in the waste places shall fall by the sword. And he's already talked about how they are lifting up their eyes to idols and shedding blood. And him that is in the open field I will give to the beasts to be devoured, and those who are in strongholds and in caves shall die by pestilence, and I will make the land a desolation and a waste, and her proud might shall come to an end, and the mountains of Israel shall be so desolate that none will pass through. Then you will know that I am the Lord, when I have made the land a desolation and a waste, because of all their abominations which they have committed. Now, I guess the point is obvious. If you commit abominations, something might happen to the land. So if something is happening to the land, it could well be that you're committing abominations, right? I mean, you could take that reversal and say that if things are really happening to your land, then there's some explanation for it. It's just not simply in nature. Nature and human nature are interrelated. And somehow what happens with human nature affects what happens with nature. Now, I think it's obvious with ozone depletion that what happens with human nature is affecting nature. I think it's questionable, but it's possible to say that what happens to our climate is in part because of what we do.
I would ask you a question. Might not Homo Neanderthalus, when the glaciers began moving south, have made the same argument that we're being attacked by these glaciers because the quality of our sacrifice has been insufficient?
I think they could. They could have made the same argument. I'm not sure it holds as much because I think the cause and effect of climate and of things like ozone depletion and...
I agree, and I hear what you're saying. And the way I think of this, this idea of God striking us down because we use too much gas. The Maharishi, the guy who taught TM to the West, said that oftentimes it's not that God strikes you down because you're doing something bad. It's that the universe supports you if you're walking along the path of evolution. And if you're not on the evolutionary path, it's not that God is necessarily going to strike you down or hurl a bolt from heaven, but that there's no universe support. I mean, that's not where the energy of the universe is. It's not going to sustain that culture. You're not moving in the direction that it wants to be. And
I would use that same language.
I'm more comfortable with the fact that we're bringing it upon ourselves and blowing it because we're getting 20 miles to the gallon rather than God hates me or I'm going to strike down my civilization because I'm getting 20 miles to the gallon. We're not on the universe. We're not on the path of evolution when we're consuming the planet.
My question a little bit is your understanding of God. If God is in Christ are the very structure of the universe, then you can use Tillich's ontology to say that what we in our freedom have done is to disregard destiny. What you're talking about is destiny, and destiny is God. So I can use different language, and this Old Testament language is a little personalistic and a little too kind of intentional for me, but it still is there, and it still represents an interpretation that with my tongue in my cheek, I accept. I accept the fact that what the environmental revolution does is to say there's something radically wrong with the way we are living, with our values, with the meaning structure, with what we're about, and what we spend our time getting and spending. And all it does is to say, stop, look, listen, listen. I'm really convinced. And I call my book, Listen to the Crying of the Earth. Listen to the crying of the earth. And ask yourself what that crying of the earth means about the way you personally have responded to the potentialities and the opportunities and the gifts that life has given you. Well, I don't want to make too much of this Old Testament stuff, but it's very interesting what you find sometimes when you have a certain perspective. And they would say, well, I was looking for it. Right? I was looking for it. Now the question is, what is wrong? What if something is wrong? If the environmental revolution, if the real significance of the environmental revolution is in pointing to something significantly destructive or questionable about our being, what is it that it points to? And what I come out of, time and time again, is that image in 1 Corinthians 12, that Pauline image of the body. It's an organic image, and you're very familiar with it, and I'll use it again in the Vespers tonight, that just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body, though many, are one, so it is with Christ. So my thesis is, if we're in Christ, Christ in us is in us, that we're parts of a body, and that body includes everything and everybody. Now it takes a little bit of pushing of this, because here it's sort of an image for the church, for those who are in Christ. But if you go to John, the Gospel of John, the Word was in the beginning, and in and through the Word was everything created that was created. And Colossians had the same image, and Philippians has the same image, that Christ represents, is, embodies, points to the reality of God. God who is in, through, underneath, above, everything, connects everything. And of course, some of the modern scientists are saying that that's what they are discovering in their science. Everything is connected with that first bang. Everybody's DNA was involved in that first bang. We are all connected. And they will tell you that something can happen here, and a response will be over here, and there's no connection between them. There are all kinds of realities, the scientists are saying, that connect us to each other. So when I say that, if you take this Pauline image seriously, when somebody dies in Ethiopia, part of you dies, I'm serious. I think that the fundamental image of the Western culture is of a kind of isolated self, externally related to other people. Related to other people in terms of usefulness of other people, rather than being integrally, in fact, related to everybody and everything. So I'm related to dumbbell, the mountain, and copper. I'm related. I mean, this stuff of ours. Now, that's not the way we tend to look at life, and not the way our disciplines tend to look at life and how we conceive of our relations to other people. So my thesis is that what the environmental revolution is saying to us, we have the wrong image of God. It's if somehow we could possess that image of God, as if you could realize that image of God alone. And I say you can't. And I go so far as to be so radical as to say, there is no salvation alone. We are saved in community. We are saved together. Now that's, I say you can be justified. That is, in other words, you can be acceptable in God's sight. But if you're being saved, sanctified is the word the theologians use. If you are coming into your fulfillment, if you are being what you're created to be, you are in relation to other people. And you have these deep relations to other people and to the universe. But that's the implication of what I'm reading. And I'm sure that it's what I want to find, because I started this covenantal community, intentional Christian community, in which we make these affirmations about our caring and being for each other back in 77. Out of Holden, all came out of Holden. We were here reading about the Bruderhof in the East, the communities, and we decided we should live in community. And so we went back to Chicago and began to create this community. Well, the community is too small in its conception, because you have to be related to everything. You can't just be related to people. Our community is much too much. We've got 15 families in a garden, but we ought to be growing all our own food. And so I was talking to somebody today, Paul Olson. He's talking, what am I going to do with this big lawn in my front of my house? I said, grow. Have the most perfect garden in the world in that front lawn. I mean, if you read anything about the pesticides that you're ingesting every day, you wouldn't buy anything that comes in from third world countries, because they're using all the pesticides that we have banned, and they you know, they all kinds of things. And the Natural Resources Defense Council gets lambasted all the time for what it did for this Alcar here, and how it undermined, and how false it was, and everything. But there's enough evidence, it seems to me, to indicate that food ought to be organically grown, and it ought to be grown without pesticides, that is, without fertilizer or pesticides. And we could do it. I mean, we've got a compost pile now. We take about 40, 50 pounds a week and have a composting bin, and I supervise it and haul it down most of the time. I don't know what they're doing while I'm away, but I'm assuming somebody will take care of it. At any rate, what God is saying to us. Now, what are the implications of this for economics and politics and education? I think economics in theory and practice has an image of the person that I would call very destructive and very demonic. And this book, For the Common Good, Redirecting the Economy Toward Community and Environment in a Sustainable Future, by Herman Daly and John Kopp, steady state economist and a theologian. Most people wouldn't consider Daly an economist, because he doesn't agree with them. And they never thought that John Kenneth Galbraith was an economist either, because he was too far out and too progressive. But certainly the University of Chicago economists would not agree. And one of my friends, dear friends, who got his PhD with me, actually, theology and economics, wrote a 33-page critique of this book. And he's got a sixth edition of his Economic Way of Thinking out. And he's been advising all Eastern European countries. And he thinks that, I'm telling you all of these things in order not to give you the notion that I simply buy into anybody's critique, that there are all kinds of pros and cons, and I've made a long analysis of his critique. And we just taught a course, and we used this book. Actually, we read every single page, every chapter of that book in this course in the Divinity School, and with a few advanced students from the university. And they say that the understanding of economics, in which you have this isolated self, person with insatiable desires, with fairly rational approach to how to satisfy the wants and desires, is the tailings are a perfect example of what you get if you just let the interests of people and the interests of corporations be the guiding images. For it's not all disastrous, actually. I'm much in favor of a $3 or $4 tax on gasoline, which would use the market, but the market alone and the system alone will not provide that tax. Now in Europe, all gasoline is $3 or $4 a gallon, and I don't know why. We can't even get 4.33 cents a gallon that they're now proposing. And it's doubtful whether they will get that tax. It's very doubtful. We should have a carbon tax, you know, in my estimation. But the market, whose interest is represented by the carbon tax? Whose, you know, your grandchildren's interests are probably represented. We have enough gasoline probably to last 85, 90, maybe 150 years. Who knows? But not too long. I mean, at the rate we're using it, 24 billion barrels a year, and there are about a trillion barrels of oil that we affirm that's what we have. So it's going to last a while. So who's going to vote for with the dollars? Who's going to represent? And that's the real problem with our politics. We don't have anybody whose kind of material interests, whose guts, represent this future, represent our grandkids. I mean, we have a certain concern and a feeling for them if they're our grandkids, but it isn't too real in terms of our daily lives and what you'd call a kind of sensual gut needs, wants, desires, orientations will not lead to dealing with the environmental revolution. So how do you deal with it? Well, I'd say in politics, I don't know how to do with economics except to have the political intervene in the economic. That's the only way I know. And then we've got all the ideology against that intervention. And of course, with the demise of Eastern Europe, we have a tremendous sense that we have won, that is, that the people who thought that the organization of life around some central focus was disastrous have been proven right. Well, they've been proven right and wrong. I mean, because we have the same kind of environmental problems here. They actually have worse environmental problems. So the form of the organization of the economy didn't make any difference. You've got the tailings out here. We spent $3 million trying to wrap those tailings so that the cyanide and other particulates and toxic waste wouldn't get down in Railroad Creek and get in Chelan Lake. And the engineers say, well, the center of those tailings is a fluid mass. And at any point, they could break out and just move all over and all the way, you know, that this wrapping is very dubious. And I had an economist tell me, and he's a what you'd call a neoclassical economist, so he wouldn't have any reason to be on my side. He said that it would take $500 billion to clean up the waste, and if you took the military waste, it will take $5 trillion to clean up the waste that we have left. Who represents the people who are being affected by the toxicity of these wastes? All I'm saying is that our systems, our economic system and our political system, neither one have theory or practice which allows what I call the environmental revolution to be dealt with. Now I must stop because I'm supposed to give time for discussion. I just say one thing about education. Education is the same boat. And these authors really talk about the extent to which education is so fragmented and there's no real necessity in an educational institution to talk to anybody who's outside of your little fragmented what they call a misplaced concreteness. I mean, you think you got the world, you know, because you've got the economic way of thinking. Well, the economic way of thinking is a kind of way of thinking, but the economic way of thinking doesn't take into account the environmental way of thinking. And somehow these two ways have to be brought in conversation. But that's very difficult in most educational institutions. And the church, and theological education. Theological education chiefly involved with history and not with listening to the Word of God that comes out of the environmental revolution or out of the violence that occurred in Los Angeles. So with that, I talk a little about the church eventually. Or there's all kinds of literature out on that table if you want to pick it up. And I really think the church has to deal particularly with this theological issue of the nature of the image of God and the nature of God. And it's a big theological task. The best book I know to deal with that is Imaging God by Douglas John Hall, which is that book on the end, which I think is, of course, he agrees with me, so, or I agree with him. So what's your reaction? Where are you? Is this truth? Is it fiction? Is it...
It may seem to be a little diversion, but I'd like to steal a minute to... I went down to Narnia today to share some stories with the little children in Narnia, and told them the story of Old Man Coyote and Grandfather Rock. And it's a typical example of one of these stories that comes out of the Native American tradition, that at face, first blush, seems to be just a simple little child's tale, but in the story of Old Man Coyote is walking along and he becomes hungry. He comes to Grandfather Rock and takes out his hunting knife and says, if you'll help me find some food, I'll give you this knife. And he turns around and there's a buffalo that has been slain. But he goes down and he thinks, how am I going to cut this up? I need a knife. I wonder what I did with my knife. And goes back and tells Grandfather Rock, you're just a rock. You don't need this knife. I'll take it. I need it. And turns around to reclaim the buffalo, and he finds that all he has is a pile of bones and skin. And then he hears this ominous sound, gutta-rum, gutta-rum, gutta-rum. And he turns around, and there he sees this large rock rolling down the hill after him. And so Old Man Coyote turns to the various animals around, the bears and the lions and the other animals, to rescue him from Grandfather Rock. They all respond by saying, if you have angered Grandfather Rock, you will have to bear the consequences. Yeah. And eventually he gains a temporary reprieve by lying. He enlists the help of the magpies by telling them that Grandfather Rock said they were ugly pinched-beaked birds. And they fly at the rock and try to destroy it, and temporarily they do, but then when they realize that Old Coyote has betrayed them, then they reassemble the rock, and pretty soon, gutta-rum, 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 he hears that ominous sound again, and this time there is no reprieve. And Old Man Coyote is flattened like a pancake. And it's a story about the consequences of failing to respect and live with integrity with Grandfather Rock, that stands for all creation.
Yeah.
And if you betray Grandfather Rock in an arrogant and self-centered way, there will be consequences, and you are simply deluding yourself if you think that you will, in any ultimate sense, escape those consequences. And one of the greatest delusions of all is if you think that creation itself is going to rescue you. It's an interesting, fascinating story that invites us to think about our relationship to creation. And, yeah. And what the consequences are of breaking faith and acting in an arrogant and self-centered way in relation to created order.
Actually, Peter Rotzek has his new book, The Voice of the Earth. I probably stole the voice of God and notion from it. At any rate, his thesis is that the endemic psychosis of our time is the belief that we have no ethical responsibility for the planet Earth. That's psychosis. And that's in the sense that children, he's affirming, at a deep level, are animistic, are really have feelings and connections with the earth, and that we have educated them away from those feelings and destroyed. So in that sense, it's psychotic. I mean, there's a repression of this being part of us that is almost, from the very beginning, his thesis is related to the natural world.
We were just talking briefly the other day, and you mentioned somewhere about listening to God, what you're saying is in Dumbbell and Copper Peak and Rose Creek, and also I think from what I get, you know, in violence and starvation and tragedy and all kinds of other calamities. And I guess that's the part I have a hard time maybe understanding. I don't have a hard time understanding how I could be there, but I sort of picturing that or getting connected to that is difficult for me. Am I understanding the question?
Anybody want to respond? I'm going to be quiet mostly.
I think it's just saying that we're all a part of, that we're all a part of everything. That we come from the same Big Bang, as you referred to, as everything else in creation. So that we have some relationship to the rocks and the trees, the creeks.
It's a question of mindfulness too, that not just recognizing that we share life together with the Creator, but that creation has a wisdom that we need. That the animals and the trees and the creeks and the rocks actually have something to say to us, and that we ignore the wisdom of creation at our own peril. And that's part of the, I don't want to be self-promoting here, but it's one of the reasons why I picked as a title for the presentation I'm doing in the storytelling hour today called Listening to the Turtle. It's really a story about that something actually happened in the city of Middleton where there was a question of development. There was a developer that wanted to widen the road and push it through and build a bunch of new houses, and the people in the neighborhood were concerned about how this would impact on their own safety and their own children and the environment. And one of the ladies actually went down to Stryker's Pond, which is a pond right in the middle of that area. And she actually went down to the pond and asked the pond for some kind of wisdom about what was to be done. And the day that the Middleton City Council was meeting to make a decision about whether to initiate legal action to oppose this development, a painted turtle climbed out of Stryker's Pond and walked across the road into this woman's front yard, dug a nest, and laid 18 eggs in that nest, covered it up, and went back to Stryker's Pond. And they fortunately had a video camera and took pictures of this. And so at that night, at the council meeting, they showed just a small 3-minute clip of that painted turtle laying eggs in that woman's lawn.
And that turned the tree.
It turned the tide, and there still is no such development in that part of the city of Middleton. Now, what did the turtle know about economics or development, or what did the turtle know about the Wisconsin judicial process or anything like that? We don't know what the turtle knows. But at the very least, the turtle was saying that my children are a part of the same neighborhood that your children are, and if your children are going to be safe, somehow my children have to be safe too. That much the turtle seemed to understand and communicate. There is a wisdom in nature that we ignore at our own peril.
I must say, I like your presentation. I agree we've got great problems. I'm not sure that returning to pantheism and animism is the solution, though. And there is a connectedness. And I think that what we need is not to dredge up the old models of connectedness, which is what I would call pantheism. I mean, that's what you have to call pantheism, everything is God, we're all God, or animism. But certainly there's a great book over there in the bookstore called The Universe Story, which develops this idea of the universe is connected. There's a guy named David Bohm, who is a physicist, who talks about mind as hologram, and talks about how it uses this as a model of explaining how the mind works, because, you know, we don't have modern science. I'm a scientist, and I can say this without fear of challenge. Anybody know anything about it would agree. There is no model of how the human mind works. When I went and did my undergraduate work and my graduate work, the most honest statement I ever had by one of my professors was, we don't deal with those questions, we just make that a black box. And we deal with input and output. It's still a black box phenomenon. And the appealing thing, and I think the solution to this, to our problem, just the very thing you're talking about, is not animism or pantheism, but rather a higher recognition that we're related more holographically, in the sense that, in the Platonic sense, you know, Plato said it all exists in the mind of God. There are no surprises, all knowledge, all absolute. It's the only absolute place in the universe.
Yeah.
And if
Plato was wrong.
That within
Plato
us,
was wrong, but then it sounds
well,
good.
Well, he may not be wrong. You know, Paul's work would suggest that maybe he wasn't, because the fact is, if you break off a piece of a hologram and shine the light on it, you get a small reflection of the entire image. And
Plato suggests, however, that you have a form that's eternal, and that there's a kind of a foreknowledge, therefore, which I wouldn't accept. I think God is free. God is not bound by any form. He, listen to me. God has to take forms into account, but there's always a freedom.
Sure, but is he ever surprised?
History.
Is he ever surprised?
Yes, surprised.
You think he's surprised?
Yeah, I think God is surprised.
It's hard for me to imagine.
I think history is open. I think history is open.
I agree with that. But
you don't have just repetition. Prigogine, I don't know whether you know Ilya Prigogine, but Prigogine's book on Order Out of Chaos makes a great point of the fact that you have directions, you have time, and when you have time, you don't have simple repetition, so that it's not, there's always something new. Evolution, biology gives us newness. And it's just my own personal feeling, is that this is Neoplatonic, and we get into all kinds of historical, philosophical questions, but this makes it much more necessary for us to be aware of where we are in history. There's no way to get the moral imperative out of history. There's always a need to assess where we are, where we're going, what's relevant. And that means that you have to pay attention to what's going on and listen much more than we do to what's going on, because you simply can't get, I mean, you take the gay lesbian issue, I mean, if you take some of the, and they're always quoting the Old Testament there, it was very interesting, we voted to ordain gays and lesbians in our church, and we lost a couple of our theological professors on it. I say they thought they were part of too liberal a church and it would affect them. That's my nasty kind of interpretation of what happened. But they left, and we had this black lesbian, and we had a black woman in our church, just the most choice person. I love her. And she is so real and so down to earth. But she thinks it's wrong to be a lesbian. So this lesbian woman said, you take the Bible now that's printed in red, where what Jesus said is printed in red, and you find one thing that Jesus has said about being a gay or lesbian. And she said, you won't find anything. There simply isn't one word that Jesus said. So, you know, I mean, you've got the Old Testament, and you've got that historical reality and the response to that, and then you've got the New Testament, and then you've got the church history. And so all I'm saying is new occasions teach new duties, and the character of those new duties is not very clear. It's very clear that we didn't have to worry about ozone depletion before we got chlorofluorocarbons, and now that we got chlorofluorocarbons and methyl chloride and a few other things that do the same thing to the global warming, we have new duties. I just don't want us to get caught in any general statement which would indicate that you can get out of history the content of the moral imperative. You got to work at it. You really have to work at it. And that's why I say in the church you need groups of people who are working at different things. Nobody can work at all this stuff. Nobody can work. And that's why I gave my matins on focus. You've got to focus. You've got to, yourself you've got to focus. And you don't even know what would be good for El Salvador. I'm still living in Leia's presentation, unless you focus like she did on being present in El Salvador. And we had a member of our church and his wife and family that spent 3.5 years as the assistant to the Lutheran bishop in El Salvador. Well, they have a kind of connection with something, with a country, with the reality of a country, and in a sense can say something about what's happening. But if you don't have that kind of experience, or you don't have the kind of experience with sexual abuse that some of the people here have, then you really don't quite know what's going on and what to do about it. And I'm sure that if you have that kind of experience, frequently you don't know what to do about it either. But at least you are aware that maybe God is asking us to do something that's somewhat different from what we've done before because of where we are, what the situation is. You're ready to spring, I see.
No, I don't know if I'm ready to spring. I guess I'm just thinking of the context of I'm a high school counselor, and I see that just the disintegration of family. So, and somebody I just heard talking today was talking about that basically child abuse can maybe be defined as, you know, some trauma that's not nurtured, which, you know, I see, you know, is extremely evident in my career. And I guess I'm just trying to kind of put that together, like you said, the focus on that and where the answers come from. That's what I find sort of mystifying, you know. How do we begin then, you know, to approach a topic like that, which is probably equally as intense and difficult to understand as the ozone layer or the other kinds of pollution kind of issues that you know, are
right,
talking
right,
about.
Right. Well, I mean, in the interpretations of racism now is that racism functions to cause the people who disrespect themselves to have a kind of respect as over against being black. I mean, so what are you going to do about racism? Get rid of the disrespect that people have for themselves. That's certainly one interpretation that I'm reading now, and I don't get off on that, but it's the interpretation of what's going on is so crucial for what the therapy is or what the reaction is, what responsible action is. And I don't have many answers, I must say. When I really get down deep in these things, I go out and dig in my garden. Pull weeds. Get something I can control. Oh, it is all connected. It is all connected.
Like you said, when you're able to focus and begin to understand and realize that, you know, that
you can start anywhere.
It is working.
You can start anywhere, and I think you get to some of the fundamental assumptions and statements I made about the image of God in us, and what kind of an image we have, and what kind of an image of what kind of a God we have, and what kind of being we have, and all these things are so interconnected that if you move in one direction, you uncover the whole shebang, I think. So I don't care where you start, as long as you penetrate, as long as you really penetrate. You know, response, church ought to have these penetration groups on various subjects and just penetrate. We started with Central America about 10 years ago and read Penny Lernoux's Cry of the Oppressed, and out of it came, you know, all kinds. We had 20 people in Central America. We We wrote a position paper. We've had two families in sanctuary. We still have one gal that we're supporting with thousands of dollars a year for her schooling from Guatemala. My wife went to Nicaragua and Guatemala, and it all started because we kind of focused. And now we're still there. We're still trying to get sister church relationship in Guatemala. That seems to be, I don't know what to do about El Salvador. Nobody knows what to do about El Salvador. Nobody knows what to do about Guatemala. And of course, Nicaragua is kind of on hold. Nobody, I mean, it seems to, but still our church, because it focused, my wife just tutored a woman who's married to an El Salvadoran, and she's a Mexican, and you can't believe the rich relationships that came out of that simple act of tutoring, and the sense of her involvement in El Salvador now, because she offered to tutor. And then I got my grandson to go over and tutor one of their kids too. He's on a postdoc at the university in a subject I can't understand. Any rate, I think it's about time to call us at an end, unless somebody has some real wisdom. Somebody has some. I do have a great deal of material on what the church could be about and how to do it. And I think every church should have a kind of a task force on the environment. And I have here an inventory that we made in our church of the issues in the church, you know, all the simple kinds of things that you can do about recycling. And we've just hired Inspired Partners to come in and do a complete energy audit of the church. And I mean, Scott was saying last night that this new chalet, and I mean the redoing of the chalet, will save 2/3 of the energy, so that if they can do all the chalets like that, they can, you know, the winter problem in energy here will be solved. And it's not just saving the energy, it's saving all the trees and all the carbon dioxide that goes up and all the rest of the stuff that's involved in saving it. So it's a complex thing, and I've got an article out there on why we should eat less meat. I mean, eat no meat, of course, but I say less. And I was up here and I was reading Diet for New America by John Robbins from the Baskin Robbins, and you know, he's completely turned his back on his inheritance because he just feels it's so crucial. Become a vegetarian. There's a big book by Dean Ornish on reversing heart disease, which makes the point of, well, he's got four disciplines, actually claims he's reversed heart disease with no chemicals, simply vegetarian eating, exercise, community, I mean being with a group of people working on this together, and being related to what he calls a higher power. I mean, all this stuff, I mean, it's relevant for every single person, because it, you know, I've had a triple bypass. I'm 80, and I'm living off of that triple bypass, and now trying to live in terms of Dean Ornish's kind of discipline. But it affects your own future. I mean, this kind of trying to deal with the very particular demands of life. In terms of being, now, you could say, well, you know, I just think the opportunities, I think the greatest thing is to be retired, and then you are free to be anything you want to be. And right. It's, you don't have to do anything to earn a living. And but the opportunities are so great. And you can, and there's no time in life, young or old, when the opportunities aren't there. So with that, I will wish you all a happy old age.